Imagine it's 3 in the morning. Your phone is buzzing. The on-call alert is screaming. You've got 200 containers spread across a fleet of machines, and half of them just fell over because one host ran out of memory. Nobody manually restarted them. Nobody rerouted traffic. The whole thing is just dead. That was the world before Kubernetes.
And honestly, that was also the world a lot of teams were living in even after Docker came out. Because Docker solved the packaging problem beautifully, but running containers at scale, that's a completely different beast.
Welcome to Cloud Talks. I'm Emma and this is Ryan, and today we are going deep. Like really deep. We're talking about Docker and Kubernetes, what they actually are under the hood, how they work, how they relate to each other, and when you genuinely need one versus the other.
No fluff. No, containers are like shipping containers, analogies that make engineers cringe. Real internals. Let's go.
All right, Ryan, let's start at the very bottom. What is a container, actually? Because I still hear people say it's like a lightweight VM, and that's not quite right.
It is so not right. A VM has its own kernel. A container shares the host kernel. That's the fundamental distinction. When you run a Docker container, you are not booting a new OS. You're running a process or a group of processes with an illusion of isolation baked in by the kernel itself.
And that illusion comes from two main Linux primitives, namespaces and croups.
Exactly. Namespaces are about isolation. The kernel has these different namespace types, PID namespaces, network namespaces, mount namespaces, UTS for host names, IPC for inter-process communication. When Docker creates a container, it creates a new set of namespaces for it. So from inside the container, process ID 1 is your main process, not the hosts in it. It thinks it has its own network stack, its own file system mount tree, its own host name.
But it's all fake. It's a view. The host kernel is doing the actual work.
Right. The process is still just a process from the kernel's perspective. It has a real PID on the host, maybe 4782, but inside its PID namespace, it looks like PID 1. That's the magic. Pure kernel bookkeeping.
And groups, control groups, that's the resource enforcement layer, right?
Yes. C groups let you say, this group of processes can use at most 2 CPU cores and 1 gigabyte of RAM. The kernel enforces that at a hardware level. So when you do Docker run a memory 512M, you're setting a C group limit. If the container tries to allocate more memory, the kernel OOM killer comes in and terminates the offending process. No negotiation.
Which is why containers feel so fast to start compared to VMs. You're not booting anything. You're just forking exit into a process with some namespace and croup set up around it.
Exactly. Container startup is typically under a second. VM startup is measured in tens of seconds at best. Totally different model.
Okay, so isolation is handled. But what about the file system? Because Docker images are clearly not just binaries, they've got a full Linux user land in there.
This is where Union file systems come in, specifically OverlayFS, which is what Docker has used as its default storage driver for years. The idea is layered. An image is made up of layers, read-only layers stacked on top of each other. When you run a container, Docker adds a writable layer on top of those read-only layers.
And OverlayFS merges them transparently. So from inside the container you see one coherent file system. But writes only go to that thin writable layer. The base image layers are shared across all containers running from the same image.
Which means if you have 50 containers all running from the same Jinx base image, you don't have 50 copies of that base image on disk. You have one set of read-only layers and 50 thin writable layers on top.
That's a massive storage win. Let's talk about Dockerfiles for a second, because I think the layering model really clicks once you understand how images get built.
Sure. Every instruction in a Dockerfile, from run, copy, env, each one creates a new layer. Docker caches those layers based on content and instruction order. So if you're building your image and you hit a cached layer, Docker skips regenerating it. That's the layer cache, and it can turn a 5-minute build into a 10-second build.
With the catch being that the cache is invalidated for all subsequent layers if something earlier changes. So the classic mistake is putting your copy of the source code early in the Docker file before you install dependencies. One source file change invalidates everything.
The pattern is install dependencies first, copy your package.json, run npm install, then copy your source. Dependencies change rarely, source changes constantly. Your build stay fast.
And then multi-stage builds took this even further. Talk me through what happens there.
Multi-stage builds are brilliant for compiled languages especially. You have a build stage, maybe a Go image with all the compilers and dev tools, and it compiles your binary. Then you have a final stage, a minimal image like Alpine or even Scratch. You copy just the compiled binary from the build stage into the final image. The result is an image that's maybe 15 megabytes instead of 800, because all the build toolchain got left behind.
And the image is the immutable thing, it's the template. The container is the running instance. Image is the class, container is the object if you want an OP analogy.
I like that. One image, infinite containers. Each container gets its own writable layer, its own network namespace, its own process tree.
Okay. Let's talk Docker networking before we move to Kubernetes, because networking in Docker has a few modes and they're important to understand.
The default mode for containers is bridge networking. Docker creates a virtual bridge, Docker Zero on Linux, and every container gets a virtual Ethernet pair. One end goes into the container's network namespace as F0, the other end hangs off the bridge. The bridge does NAT via iptables to let containers reach the outside world.
Containers on the same bridge can talk to each other using their IP addresses. And Docker has user-defined bridge networks where containers can also resolve each other by name. That's the built-in container DNS.
Right. Docker runs a tiny DNS resolver at 127.0.11 that containers query. On a user-defined network, if you name your container Postgres, other containers on that same network can just ping Postgres and it resolves. Docker handles the DNS record automatically based on container names and network aliases.
Host networking mode is the other extreme. The container shares the host's network namespace entirely. No isolation, no NAT, the container's ports are just host ports. Useful for performance-sensitive things or network monitoring, but you lose the isolation.
And there's none networking, where the container has no network interface at all. Useful for batch jobs that don't need the network.
All right. So at this point we have Docker, great packaging, great local development story. You can Docker run your app, it's isolated, it works on your machine and on your colleague's machine and in CI. Beautiful.
But then you get to production. And production is not one machine.
Right. Let's paint the picture. You've got a microservices app. 20 services. You're running 3 instances of each for redundancy. That's 60 containers. Spread across, say, 8 machines. Now, which container runs on which machine? What happens when a machine goes down? What happens when a container crashes? How does traffic get balanced across those 3 instances of your API service?
Docker alone doesn't answer any of those questions. Docker Compose gets you multi-container on a single machine. Docker Swarm tried to do cluster orchestration, but it never really took off. The answer the industry converged on was Kubernetes.
Kubernetes. The name literally means helmsman in Greek, the person who steers the ship. And it's Google open sourcing a decade of internal container orchestration experience, codified in what they called Borg.
Let's do the architecture. Because Kubernetes architecture is actually really well designed once you understand why each piece exists. There's a control plane and worker nodes.
The control plane is the brain. It's where decisions get made. And there are 4 key components. The API server, KubeApp Observer, is the front door to everything. Every interaction with Kubernetes goes through the API server. When you run kubectl apply, you're sending an HTTP request to the API server. When a node needs to check its workload, it talks to the API server.
The API server is the single source of truth for desired state. But it doesn't store state itself, that's Etched's job. Etched is a distributed key-value store, specifically designed for consistency and reliability. Every Kubernetes object, every pod, every service, every deployment, lives in Etched. The API server reads from and writes to Etched.
The scheduler watches the API server for newly created pods that don't have a node assigned yet. It scores all the available nodes based on resource requests, node affinity rules, taints and tolerations, and picks the best one. Then it writes the binding. This pod goes on node 3, back to the API server.
And the controller manager is this collection of control loops, reconciliation loops, that constantly compare actual state to desired state and try to close the gap. The replica set controller sees you want 3 replicas but only 2 are running, so it creates a third pod. The node controller sees a node stopped sending heartbeats, so it marks it as not ready and starts evicting pods. Each controller does one job and does it in a loop.
That reconciliation model is the heart of Kubernetes. You declare what you want, Kubernetes figures out how to get there, and keeps trying until reality matches your declaration. It's level triggered, not edge triggered.
Then on each worker node you have 3 main things. The Kubelt is the node agent. It talks to the API server, watches for pods assigned to its node, and makes sure those pods are running. If a container crashes, the Kubelt restarts it. If a pod doesn't pass its health checks, the Kubelt reports that.
KubaProxy handles network rules on the node. It watches the API server for service objects and updates IPTables or IPvS rules, so that traffic to a service's virtual IP gets load balanced across the healthy pods behind it. The container runtime, Docker, or more commonly container today, actually pulls images and runs containers.
Kubernetes decoupled itself from Docker as the runtime. It uses the container runtime interface, CRI, which is just a gRPC API. Containered and CIO are the 2 most common CRI implementations now. Docker itself uses containered under the hood anyway.
Let's talk primitives, because this is where people new to Kubernetes often get lost. What is actually running in Kubernetes?
The smallest deployable unit is a pod. A pod is 1 or more containers that share a network namespace and optionally shared volumes. They always co-schedule together, they live and die on the same node. The canonical use case is a main container plus a sidecar, like your app container plus a logging or metrics agent container in the same pod.
Pods are ephemeral. You don't manage pods directly in production. They have no built-in restart policy, no self-healing. For that, you use a deployment.
A deployment manages a replica set, which manages a set of identical pods. You tell the deployment, I want 3 replicas of this image on this port. The deployment creates a replica set. The replica set creates 3 pods. The scheduler places them on nodes. The Kubelt on each node starts the containers.
And if one crashes, the replica set controller notices the actual count drop below 3 and creates a replacement. Automatically. Without anyone's phone buzzing at 3 in the morning.
Now to expose those pods to traffic, you need a service. A service is a stable virtual IP and DNS name that routes to a set of pods selected by labels. The service exists independently of the pods. Pods come and go. The service stays.
There are 3 main service types. Cluster IP, the default, gives you a virtual IP that's only reachable inside the cluster. Perfect for internal microservice communication. Node port opens a port on every node in the cluster and routes it to your service. Load balancer provisions an external load balancer from your cloud provider, an AWS ELB, a GCP load balancer, and routes to the service.
Config maps and secrets are for configuration. Config map is for non-sensitive config, environment variables, config files, command line flags. Secret is the same idea but for sensitive data, API keys, passwords, TLS certificates. They're Base64 encoded by default, which is encoding, not encryption. Real secret management usually involves something like vault or sealed secrets.
Ingress sits at the edge of the cluster and does HTTP routing. You configure rules like request to api.myapp.com/users go to the user service. Request to api.myapp.com/orders go to the order service. You need an ingress controller, and Jinx Ingress and Trafic are popular, which runs as pods and does the actual routing based on ingress objects.
Let's walk through what actually happens when you do a rolling update. You run kubectl apply fdeployment.yaml with a new image tag. What happens?
The API server receives your request, validates it, writes the updated deployment object to ECT. The deployment controller sees the change. The desired pod template has changed, so it creates a new replica set with the new image. Then it starts incrementally scaling up the new replica set and scaling down the old one.
By default, Kubernetes uses a rolling update strategy with max surge of 1 and max unavailable of 1. So it'll bring up one new pod before it terminates one old pod. It waits for the new pod to be ready, meaning it passes its readiness probe, before continuing.
Readiness probes are critical here. They're how Kubernetes knows a pod is actually ready to serve traffic. You define a probe and HTTP GET to your health endpoint, or a TCP check or a shell command. If the probe fails, the pod is removed from service endpoints. Traffic stops going to it. The rollout pauses and waits.
This means zero downtime deployments are actually achievable if you configure your probes correctly. The old pods keep serving until the new ones are proven healthy.
And if something goes wrong, kubectl rollout undo deployment / my app rolls back to the previous replica set. Kubernetes keeps a history of replica sets so rollback is fast. It's just updating which replica set is the active one.
Let's talk Kubernetes networking because it's genuinely complex and there's a lot of magic happening. Every pod gets its own IP address. Not a host mapped port, an actual IP. Pods can communicate with any other pod directly by IP, across nodes, without NAT.
This is the flat network model that Kubernetes requires, but Kubernetes doesn't implement it. It delegates to CNI plugins. CNI is the Container Network Interface, another plugin API. Calico, Flannel, Weave, Cilium. These are CNI plugins that wire up the overlay networks or BGP routing that make pod-to-pod communication work across nodes.
Calico is popular in production because it uses BGP and native routing where possible, no overlay tunneling overhead. Cilium is exciting because it uses eBPF to do network policy enforcement at the kernel level with much lower overhead than iptables.
Service discovery inside the cluster uses KubeDNS, which is actually core DNS these days. Every service gets a DNS entry. Servicename.namespace svc.cluster.local. Pods query core DNS automatically. So your app can just connect to postgres.database svc.cluster.local, and it'll resolve to the cluster IP of the Postgres service.
KubeProxy is responsible for the iptables rules that implement the load balancing behind that cluster IP. When you send a packet to a cluster IP, iptables intercepts it and DNATs it to one of the healthy pod IPs. This is round-robin by default. IPvS mode is faster for large clusters because iptables rules don't scale well into the thousands.
Okay, we have to talk about the elephant in the room. When do you not need Kubernetes? Because I've seen too many startups running a 3-node Kubernetes cluster for an app that gets 50 requests per day.
This is so important. Kubernetes has very real operational complexity costs. You need to understand the control plane. You need to size your nodes. You need to manage upgrades, and Kubernetes upgrades can be exciting in a bad way. You need to understand RBAC, network policies, resource requests and limits, pod disruption budgets.
The YAML. Oh God, the YAML. A simple three-tier app on Kubernetes might require 8 or 9 YAML files. A deployment for each service, a service for each, a config map, maybe an ingress, maybe some persistent volume claims. And the YAML has opinions about whitespace that will humble you.
For local development, Docker Compose is almost always the right answer. You write one YAML file, you do Docker Compose up, and your entire app stack, app, database, cache, message queue, spins up locally in seconds. That's the perfect use case.
For production with a single service that doesn't need to scale massively, a single VM running Docker is totally fine. You get your isolation, your image-based deployments, your restart policies. Throw a reverse proxy like Caddy in front for TLS and routing. Done. No ECT quorum to maintain.
The inflection point for Kubernetes is roughly multiple services that need to scale independently, need to be deployed frequently, need zero downtime updates, and are running across multiple machines. Once you're there, once you genuinely need the orchestration, Kubernetes pays for its complexity.
Or you use a managed Kubernetes service, EKS on AWS, GKE on Google Cloud, AKS on Azure, where someone else runs the control plane for you. Then the operational burden drops significantly.
Still have to deal with the YAML though.
Always have to deal with the YAML.
Let me give you the mental model that I find most useful. Docker is about packaging. You take your application, its runtime, its dependencies, its config, and you package all of that into a portable, reproducible unit. That unit runs the same everywhere. That's Docker's promise, and it delivers.
Kubernetes is about running that packaged unit at scale. It's the operating system for your data center. It handles placement, which machine does this container run on? It handles healing, what happens when a container or machine fails? It handles scaling, add more replicas when load goes up, remove them when it goes down. It handles updates, replace the running version with a new version without downtime.
Docker answers how do I ship my app? Kubernetes answers how do I run 100 of them reliably?
And they compose perfectly. You build your Docker image in CI. You push it to a container registry, Docker Hub, ECR, GCR. You update your Kubernetes deployment YAML with the new image tag. You apply it. Kubernetes handles the rest.
The abstraction stack is your app code, the Dockerfile that packages it, the container image that results, the Kubernetes deployment that runs it, the service that exposes it, the ingress that routes external traffic to it. Each layer solves a different problem.
One thing worth mentioning, Helm. Once you're writing enough Kubernetes YAML, you'll hit Helm, which is the package manager for Kubernetes. Instead of maintaining raw YAML, you use Helm charts templates with values you override. Installing a complex piece of infrastructure like Prometheus or Postgres becomes Helm install with a values file.
It adds another layer of abstraction that can help or can hide problems. The joke in the community is that Helm was invented so that YAML could have YAML inside it.
All right, let's land the plane, Ryan. What's your one sentence take on where people go wrong with this whole ecosystem?
Reaching for Kubernetes before they've earned it. Start with Docker Compose. Get to production with it. Feel the pain of manual scaling and you'll know exactly when you need Kubernetes and you'll understand what problem it's solving for you.
Mine is not understanding the image layer model. Teams with 15-minute Docker builds that could be 30 seconds if they just reordered their Dockerfile instructions. Fix your layer cache and everything gets faster, CI deployments, local builds.
These are the fundamentals. Namespaces and C groups for isolation, OverlayFS for efficient storage, the reconciliation loop at the heart of Kubernetes, and the mental separation between packaging and orchestration.
Thanks for joining us on Cloud Talks. This was a long one, but Docker and Kubernetes deserve the full treatment. If you're just starting out, run some containers locally, break things, read the source code if you're brave. The best way to understand a kubelet is to watch one panic at 3 in the morning.
Well said. See you next time.
Take care, everyone.